Hey everybody, welcome to a live podcast that was done at the Pro Wrestling Hall of Fame weekend in Waterloo, Iowa. A couple of notes on all of the guests. The first guest is Brian Blair from the Killer Bees. He needs no explanation. Next was going to be both Wes and Jerry Briscoe, but sadly Jerry had COVID and was unable to come to the weekend and the festivities. James Beard is a longtime referee from World Class, amongst other stints. And our last guest was Rock Riddle, who is literally a monster of a guest in the best possible way. Rock was kind of a journeyman who started doing acting in LA and is just a straight up gimmick. Maybe Luke Gallows in 35 years. So Rock went off on such a tangent about who knows what that I did do some editing on this episode. For the sake of a good flow to a good live podcast, I did trim some stories down, including one from Brian Blair and most of Rock Riddle. So if you would like to hear those, they will be up separately on my Patreon. And at $5 a month, you get two bonus episodes of Wrestling Anonymous, ad-free shows, and bonus stuff. And this will count as the bonus stuff. All right, before I start the show, Edinburgh, Scotland. I'm doing my show at the Fringe for only 3 days, me and John Hastings. So if you know anyone in or around Scotland, send them to the Fringe to watch us do comedy and commentary to bad wrestling matches. It's only £10, tinyurl.com/edfringewrestling. And I'm sure I'll put up an Art of Wrestling episode after the Fringe. And I'm sure a lot of the Fringe stuff will go up on my Patreon. Last but not least, before we jump into this live show from Waterloo, Iowa, today's podcast is brought to you by Manscaped. And again, this is the catchphrase they actually want me to say. It's written down on the notes and everything. It's smooth sack summer. Manscaped is the leader in below the belt grooming, and they want you to have a ball this summer. Dive head first into smooth sack summer by going to Manscaped for 20% off and free shipping with the code COLT. As a wrestler, I've said it before, I was taught to Manscaped very early in my life. You go into these locker rooms and it's part of wrestling culture. They're talking about drinking beer, making money, and shaving your whole body. Manscaped did send me their Performance Package 4.0, and I do use it. I get my chest, I get my armpits, I get my neck, and I get the downstairs area. Get 20% off and free shipping with the code COLT at manscaped.com. That's 20% off and free shipping with the code COLT at manscaped.com, and make sure you have, say it with me, a smooth sack summer. Manscaped.
This is the Art of Wrestling with professional wrestler Colt Cabana. It's Colt
Cabana. Thank you. All right. How you guys doing? Come on in. Sit down. Relax. You're about to listen to the Art of Wrestling, a professional wrestling podcast. It's a life podcast. It's a personal journal. It's an entryway into the minds of souls, the hearts, and the lives of the people involved in the world of professional wrestling. I am your host. My name is Colt Cabana. Hello. I am a podcaster. I'm an actor. I'm a traveler. I'm a conference goer. I'm a Hall of Famer enjoyer. Most importantly, though, I am a professional wrestler. We are not coming to you live from my studio, pretty good, in Chicago, Illinois, but we are here live at the National Wrestling Hall of Fame weekend here in Waterloo, Iowa, in front of a live studio audience. Before we go any further, this is a fan-supported and listener-supported podcast supported by people just like you. We give it to you on some Thursdays. It has slowed down at this point, but when we put it out, we give it to you free of charge. The best ways that you could support, rate, review, and subscribe on iTunes. Tell a friend, tweet it out, use social media. ColtMerch.com is where you could buy the official wares and tears of Colt Cabana. I don't know what tears means, but maybe I'm selling lotto tickets at this point. Why not, right? That's where you could buy t-shirts, pictures, buttons, used wrestling gear, whatever you need, ColtMerch.com. And then, of course, tonight, during the show, ColtMerch.table will be available, and that's where you can come see me and pick some of the stuff up. Best way to support, though, is on my Patreon, patreon.com/ColtCabana, and that's where you can get ad-free archives of the show since 2010, over 500 episodes of The Art of Wrestling, plus so many other goodies. and I appreciate you over there. We do have some fun guests set for tonight slash today. It is 3:30 in the afternoon, but I did want to chat with you, everybody, for a little bit. It's great to have a crowd here. By a round of applause, how many of you have been here to this weekend of the National Wrestling Hall of Fame? All right. And who's a firstie? All right. Great to have you here. One of the exciting things about this is not only the Hall of Fame itself, the inductees and the whole ceremony, not only the actual wrestling show that's put on or the podcast that Colt's doing here, but is the actual museum itself, which is one of the most fun things to see, is to see amateur wrestling, but also see the past of professional wrestling. And every year I go there, and every year I have questions, and I'm going to propose to you all of the unanswered questions that I have from roaming around the actual museum. Again, by another round of applause, who checked out the museum this weekend? Okay, so I checked it out a little bit before I came here, and these were some of my questions. Maybe some of you all had the same questions, and you can either find me afterwards and give me the answer, or we can wonder about it together. So my first question was, I saw Thunderbolt Patterson, who is here this weekend. He had donated a pair of boots, a pair of trunks, and then I don't know if anybody saw that airbrush t-shirt that he had in there. And my question is, like, what flea market did he buy that airbrushing at? I mean, that was straight from the mall or the flea market. Stuff we don't think about. We see him on TV and it looks cool, but the reality is like, our grandma has the same one, and someone's doing that airbrushing, and they don't even know it's for Thunderbolt. And he's like, can you put Thunderbolt and like cool airbrush on this t-shirt? And someone's just like, yeah, of course, anything for 10 bucks. And next thing you know, now it's in a Hall of Fame. So I'm just a big fan of airbrushing. The next one was Jesse the Body Ventura. Well, I'll stop myself. Jesse the Governor Ventura. Did you see that? That's the political sign that he had. Which I think is maybe a new addition this year, which was so cool. It was Jesse for governor, and it just says Jesse, and I love that everybody in Minnesota knows exactly who that is. But what I don't think anyone ever talks about was it was Jesse Ventura and May Skunk was his running partner. And so obviously my question is, who the fuck is May Skunk? Does she believe in aliens like Jesse does? And did she run on the same ticket? These are questions I had. They were unanswered. I want to know who this lady is. It's pretty impressive. Actually, I did have a question answered. The Luthez ring robe is in the National Wrestling Hall of Fame Museum. And that's such an iconic ring robe. It's so cool. I think about pictures of him wrestling in Japan with Carl Gotch, like tagged with Gotch, and just legendary NWA matches. And I wanted to know if there was anything in his front pocket, because I'm nosy, and it wasn't behind a shield, and the answer is no, there's nothing in his front pocket. So the fourth question I had, a lot of you saw Mr. Perfect singlet there, the iconic baby blue with the black triangle on the front. My question forever has been, and then I tried to find out the answer there and I wasn't able to find it, was, is there like a thinner piece of fabric around his crotch? Because as a kid, I could always just see his penis poking through, and I couldn't get to it. I wanted to know. It was always him and Jimmy Snuka were always had a little turtle head pointing at me as a child. It was very weird. It wasn't there. No one answered the question. So please, if you know, let me know. And last but not least, I would like to know, how many ladies from Flirt Gentlemen's Club have made their way over to the National Wrestling Hall of Fame? For those of you who are not here, every year we all pull up to the National Wrestling Hall of Fame, and right next to it is a gentleman's club, which has been there for a long, long time. I am honestly intrigued, because I know the conversations in a wrestling locker room. Like, what are the conversations in the gentleman's club locker room for the ladies? Do they talk about wrestling? Do they know anything about wrestler? Like, what if there's one that's like so into amateur wrestling and like can't believe Dan Gable is over there signing autographs and she can't wait to get off the stage and go? These are just my questions. They really fill up my mind, but they're unanswered. I appreciate you. Maybe if you have them later, and I appreciate everybody. My first guest, please welcome to the show, B. Brian Blair.
Good so entertaining, brother. You are entertaining.
Well,
you've got an inquisitive mind. Does he not have an inquisitive mind? Come on, audience, give him a hand. Colt Cabana, the man.
These were all questions we were all asking ourselves. I just have the heart to put it out there and wonder.
It was beautiful.
Great to have you on here. Thanks so much. You've been involved, and maybe we could talk about this right away. You've been involved in stuff. I mean, as long as I've been coming here, you've been coming here. Also, you play such a part in the Cauliflower Alley Club. Is it important to you, or where does your importance lie to kind of, I guess we would call this kind of like making sure the history is still alive and making sure that, I guess, the brother and sisterhood is still there. Does that play importance to you? And is that stuff you thought about as a younger wrestler, looking at the older wrestlers when you were in the ring?
Let me start with the last part first. I always had respect. Buddy Colt and Eddie Graham and Jack Briscoe, they taught me that you have respect for everybody. Yes, sir. No, sir. When you had to pay trans, they don't ask you for your trans. We used to have to pay 5 cents a mile trans. You know, we'd get in a car, you drive 400 miles, you pay your $40.
And can I stop you there? Yeah. Who's doing the math? Being like, Brian, you owe this, or?
No, you would automatically know if you went from Tampa to Jacksonville that was 200 miles each way. We had established miles.
Okay.
If you went to Tallahassee, that was 375. So that was heavy trans. You know, sometimes I don't have a calculator with me, but if you're only making $75 or $100, I don't think Eddie ever paid anybody less than $100. But there were guys before me that went there for a lot less. And of course, we made a lot more. Respect, and the Cauliflower Alley Club ties into the National Wrestling Hall of Fame. Because we help people that have, the Cauliflower Alley Club helps people from the wrestling industry. I don't care if you were an announcer, whatever you did, as long as you made a living in the pro wrestling industry and contributed full time, then we reach out and we help these people. We've saved people's houses, kept them from having liens on their lives, basically. And it's been a great thing. But through all this, you learn that if we don't preserve all these things and these people that have, you know, the Mr. Wonderful Paul Orndorff, you know, we were just talking about, you know, at least Thunderbolt's still with us, but we were talking about Kurt Hennig. These people contributed so much to where we're at right now. We're all together, and we want to preserve all this history. And that's really why I'm here, why we support this as a whole, as one 501c3 to another. We just want to make sure that we're successful together, because we're like brother and sister organizations, if you will.
Okay, so I'm going to touch a little bit on, you said five, so that's what stuck with me, was 5 cents a mile. Everybody's paying their own trans. Now, wrestling has transitioned all over, you know, over the years, right? It gets
$5 for 100 miles.
$5 for 100 miles. Well, it gets to the point now where, like, some of us, like, part of our deal is we want this amount, we want our trans paid for. So my guess would be, like, you know, you hear the stories that Vince would pay your one-way ticket on an airplane. Was there a point where people were getting all of their trans paid for? Were the top guys getting their trans paid for? Was this something you guys would talk about?
Well, I'm talking about in the territories.
I understand.
Yeah, Vince Sr. was a territory, of course, and they paid trans in those territories too. But then when we became like a world organization, when I went there, I think it was 1985 when the Killer Bees were born. I was there before, and I worked for his dad. But and we paid trans like up until that point. And at that point, we became so national that Vince paid for all of our flights. But then once we got somewhere, we were on our own.
Let's talk a little bit about the Killer Bees. See, that's the generation we talked about a little today. I'm from Chicago, the Rosemont Horizon. Definitely the first show I went to, headlined by Piper and Hogan. You guys were on the card 100%. I think it's been documented that Hulk Hogan had the idea to put you guys together, you and Jim Brunzel. You can correct me if I'm incorrect.
No, you're right.
Can you tell me about the relationship with Hulk Hogan and then the relationship coming together with the Killer Bees? Were you for it? Were you against it? Were you cool? Like, did you enjoy the ride?
Oh, I totally enjoyed the ride. I enjoyed the ride as much through the territories. I wish I could really explain that, because I lived half my career through the territories and the other half propelling to what you guys watch today, you know, the WrestleMania through the, I was there right before one. So you can relate in time. Then we were on 2, 3, 4, and right before 5, I gave my notice. But the times that we had, and even the times after that, because I wrestled for so many years after that.
What about you and Hulk?
Wonderful times. Terry is a, you know, ever since we used to get pounded in the dungeon, Hiro Matsuda and Gordon Nelson, and even Bob Backlund would come in, and he wasn't really a hooker, but he was a good shooter. But we were constantly getting stretched and beat up, and out of 3 summers that I trained in the dungeon where Matsuda runs the shots, only 3 people made it. And that was first Mr. Wonderful Paul Orndorff, who turned out to be one of my very, very best friends. Then I started, but I trained with Terry for 6 weeks in the dungeon. And then he had his first match with me. And it was great. Everything was a rib, too. It's always a rib. There's always a joke. Everything, you know, they changed the time limit. And
you were Hulk Hogan's first match?
Yes.
Okay. What was he wrestling as?
The Super Destroyer.
Okay.
Yes.
And?
It was in Chiefland, Florida.
How many people?
1977. I was at Chiefland High School. I would say there was probably 300 people.
Okay. And do you say to yourself, no one's going to say this guy's going to be the next biggest thing in professional wrestling. Was there any inkling of that?
Well, I used to sneak in the bar to watch him play. He played in a band called Ruckus. And there's a place called the OP and the other place. And when I was 17 years old, I'd sneak into the bar and I'd watch Terry play he was just like a freak show. He had his mama's lipstick and her jewelry on. And, it was like 6'7", suntan, plus another, 3.5 inches with the platform heels on, long blonde hair hanging on that base. And, a great band. It was a sight to see. And I got kind of, then I saw him in the armory, where we'd go on Tuesday nights to really watch all the action. Dusty Rhodes and Pandemonium, and Eddie Graham and Jack Briscoe and Buddy Colt and gosh, so many Playboy Gary Hart, all these cool stars. Joe LaDuke, all these guys that were a lot of fun. Lots of trips with Don Morocco. Anyway, so good times.
So when you're doing the territories, and for the third time you're going to come and wrestle for the WWF.
Yep.
Is it Hulk Hogan saying, I want Vince for you to come in. I think I could tag. Is he playing the role of promoter there for him to tag with Brunzell, or they had Brunzell?
Well, so this is how it happened. The Florida tape goes into New York. So I was a Florida champion. The first time I was a Florida heavyweight champion, NWA Florida heavyweight champion, and the Southern heavyweight champion. I left Florida and went to New York. I think that was 1984. And right before WrestleMania 1, had some tremendous matches with Mr. Wonderful Paul Orndorff that really, really impressed Junior. And from there, Senior liked it too. They both liked me, and I was going to come back and work for the Intercontinental title, but I had to go back to Florida. Went back to Florida, won the Florida heavyweight title, worked with Flair, and had some really fun times. But Hogan called me up and said, because Vince stole Hogan from Vern, and this is the rating period, WrestleMania 1 starts, where all the territories are getting, he slowly picks the territories and raids the top guys. Mm-hmm. So I went from being the main event, for championship wrestling from Florida, CWF, to coming down and with Vince and being 2 weeks later on a card in another building in the same town. And that's how he manipulated and got the talent, paid the talent more, and controlled the world.
You and Jim.
And Jim.
Killer Bees. I mean,
Hogan put us together because they worked together in AWA for Vern, and Jim was a natural tag team. Him and Greg Gagne were AWA tag team champions several times for quite a while. And I heard that, you know, Jimmy had a reputation of being a gentleman and a nice guy. And I had never met him in my life. So they introduced us in Brantford, Ontario, Canada, and 1985. And we meet, talking. There's a lot of people around, you know, all kinds of characters. George the Animal, Steel Snuka. I mean, tons and tons of people. Poffo's over here. But George Scott comes up to us. He had already introduced us, and he said, "Listen, we need a name now for you guys." Wow, here we are, Brantford, Ontario, trying to meet each other. So much going through our minds. Now we got to think of a name. I wish he would have told us, you know, a little bit sooner. It would have been easier. So think of something. You guys are on in 1 hour. We had 1 hour, Colt, to come up with a name. True story.
That's wild.
We're kind of thinking, and I'm thinking bees, Blair Brunzel, the Killer Bees, and oh yeah, because I love the Miami Dolphins. That's why it pops in my mind. I said, "Hey, you remember the Miami?" Now I'm speaking out loud. My mind stops, like yours likes to wander. My wandering mind stops, and I step into reality. And I said, "Do you guys remember the '82 Dolphins?" Baumgartner and all the guys, Bonacani, the linebackers, five of them all were with Bees. They were the Killer Bees, and that stuck with me all these years. And if it sticks with me that long, I think Blair and Brunzel, the Killer Bees. Jimmy goes, "That's awesome, man. I love it. Yeah. I love it. Wow, that's fantastic." And George Scott comes by, and everybody's listening. And I said, "George, how about the Killer Bees?" And he kind of smiles, and he goes, "Killer Bees, Killer Bees, Killer Bees. I'll be back in as quick as I can. I got to go ask Vince." And so we, kibitz. Everybody's kibitzing a little bit, doing their thing. A lot of characters now in that room. Brantford TV, so you got to imagine. Jesse the Body, the cast goes on. In comes George with a big smile on his face. He said, "Hey, you guys are now the Killer Bees," and he's excited about it. So I'm excited about it. All right, the Killer Bees, and Brunzi's excited, and Lanny Poffo is extremely excited, and he has a bag, like a hockey bag, and he reaches down and he pulls out a pair of bumblebee tights.
Come on.
The same ones we wore. So Lanny Poffo actually had those in his bag before we wore them.
Were you like, "Why do you have these, Lanny? What's the story?"
He had more gimmicks than anybody I'd seen in my life. He could be a knight. He could be an elf. He could be whatever he wanted to be. Poet. You know, he had all the gimmicks.
If Vince needs a bee, I'll be a bee. No problem.
Beautiful. You got it, brother. And, that's the deal.
I mean, it was such a fun marketing gimmick of my childhood that it's so fun to hear that story, come about.
Yeah, at one time, and I actually have a book that just recently came out called Truth Be Told. It was number one.
Truth Be Told.
Yeah, Truth Bee Told, available on Amazon. For everything that I've touched on with Colt in these few short, wonderful minutes, which I truly appreciate.
Of course.
And I appreciate the listeners and everybody here. It's got everybody, the cast of where we all came from, and experiences that nobody's ever seen or heard before, and pictures and photos, and it's an amazing piece of art because of Ian Douglas, my co-author. He's wonderful.
Brian Blair, everybody.
Thank you. Thank you very much. God bless.
What Brian doesn't know is that when I was in the WWE, along with my next guest, actually I'm going to bring up my next guest, I had to canvass the town to get signatures for him as he was running for the Hillsborough County. What was it? Me and Evan Bourne went to Publix and got signatures for you, for your campaign. Yes. Yeah, you're welcome. Happy to do it. What was it? Hillsborough County Commission, District 6, countywide, BOCC. All right. Okay. I'm gonna bring in my next guest. So I don't know if he has any memories of this, but it'll be fun to talk about. Please welcome to the stage, Wes Briscoe. Hi, buddy.
What's up, guys? How you guys doing?
Do you remember that? When Brian would come to the school at Florida Championship Wrestling.
Yep.
2.0, sorry.
And what I want to talk about, too, is one day I was doing, I was in Puerto Rico, and you were talking about raining, and I was working for Carlos Colon, and there was a crazy downpour, and I'm like, are we going to still wrestle? Of course, Carlos is like, yep, boys, you go out there, and I'm like, what? So I go out there, and I start slipping, falling. I'm like, the canvas is so slick. I didn't know what to do. So I come back, and I'm like, man, it was the worst match of my life. I call my dad. I'm like, Dad, they made me wrestle in the rain. Like, what do I do? And he goes, dummy, you take your boots off. I wish I would have called him a little bit earlier and got that information.
That makes so much sense.
Yeah, because I never wrestled in the rain. I didn't know. But
everybody's Jimmy Snuka tonight.
Yeah, exactly. Gonna, yeah. But it was funny that you mentioned that because I actually had that same experience in Puerto Rico
and
wrestling in the rain.
You don't want to ruin your boots.
Yeah, exactly.
Now your boots are ruined.
Oh, yeah, you can't ruin the boots.
Who'd have thunk your dad knows the answer to these wrestling questions?
I know. Man, I wish I would have called him a little bit earlier. Yeah.
Oh, that's, wow. Well, did you make it? Did you have arthroscopic surgery? Three days before that?
No, I did not, okay. But I probably needed it after.
Right, fair enough. Yeah. Good to have you on here. I'm still want to know, do you remember when Brian would come to the school?
Yes, I also remember when Brian used to come to my house with his Harley that was all killer beat out.
Yes.
And I remember those good old days of him pulling up in the Harley and Nice. Yeah, they would always come. I remember there have been so many times where wrestlers would come in the middle of the night and kick me out of my bed. And I'd be like, really? And my dad, like, I forgot the, which one was it?
Ron Bass.
He's kicked me out of the bed. But the biggest guy was guy with
not giving me a lot of clues here.
I'm trying to figure it out.
I think I can get it.
What are those old school?
The Road Warriors.
No.
The Blackjacks.
No, Blackjack, he kicked me out of the bed before too. But
this all of a sudden sounds very weirdly sexual now.
No, I was a little kid. I was a little kid. They come home and instead of the boys getting the hotel, my dad was like, hey, come crash at the house.
Yeah.
And of course, I would have to leave the bed.
Of course.
You know, but there's been so many times the wrestlers coming by and stopping by. And
what would you do? You would go on the couch or?
Yeah, I would get forced to go to the couch or the dog kennel, you know.
So what was your house? So at that time, let's say if you were what? When are those memories? 10 years old or whatever?
Yeah, I was like probably 10. Yeah, right.
Like how, where was your dad in his career that wrestlers were coming over?
I think, I think at that period of the time, that was when he was controlling, like, backstage. And, like, I'm trying to remember, but I'm thinking that was when he was more of Vince's right-hand man. And, like, kind of, so the guys would stop, and he's like, you know, you guys don't need to get hotels. Come stay at the house, right. You know, come crash. But at that period of his time, I think that was when he was more of Vince's right-hand man. It was before the Stooges. It was kind of in that period when I was still a really little kid, like mm-hmm. that age.
Do you have memories of your dad actually wrestling, or had he retired by the time you were figured?
I never got to actually see him, which, you know, caused a lot of trouble in high school. I saw my dad's tapes of him being like a badass and him being, you know, tag team champions and, you know, all the stuff that he did. And then by the time I got to like sixth to seventh grade, he was doing the Stooges thing. So I got picked on a lot.
Like,
I didn't understand wrestling. I didn't understand what my dad was doing because I was at the age that I was like 13, maybe like 12, so people would make fun of me, and I like to fight, so I don't care. Like, you know, my dad's my hero. You know, make fun of him because he's wearing a dress and doing that. I'll punch in your face. Like,
so these people at your school weren't like your dad. It's so cool that was anyone else's father on television every week?
Yeah, but my dad was the way he was portrayed.
I don't care.
I was a kid. I didn't know. Yeah. And then eventually I realized.
But you would think that the other kids would know.
No,
they took it the other way.
Yeah, they took it the other way where I got bullied. Mm-hmm. I got harassed. And then, like, sometimes they'd be like, your dad's wearing makeup on TV. Like, I really would get bullied and harassed in school. And, like, you know, I got in a lot of trouble. I got kicked out of school for fighting because my dad's my hero. And people are, like, making fun of me and, like, just, you know, bullying me. And I, like, didn't, you know, I understand bullying. And that's why when people, I love shows, I say, man, stick up for each other. You guys, like, everybody needs a friend. Everyone needs somebody to stand beside you. And, you know, like, bullying is not right. And, you know, I felt that myself. And, you know, luckily, I can fight. So,
What were the conversations? Would you go, like, would you have, like, a heart-to-heart kind of, like, kid and parents situation of, like, I'm getting bullied? Would your dad be like, yeah, give him a chicken wing?
My dad's like, did you win the fight? Yeah. And I said, yeah. He goes, okay, let's go get ice cream.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Wow. So even if you would ever, if you would get in fights, which you seem to have a lot as a child, your dad was okay with it?
As long as I wasn't.
As long as you won.
As long as I wasn't the person that was egging and all, as long as I'm not the bullying, but my dad didn't want some people just to step on me and, mm-hmm. and you know, push me to a corner where, you know, I'm not going to back out,
yeah.
you know? And, like, I never picked on no one. I never was. If I was going to fight someone, it was because either I saw someone getting picked on and I stood up for that person, or it was because I felt that they were really hurting me and, like, I had nothing else to do. Like, I had to,
yeah.
had to fight back.
Was your house a wrestling house? And meaning, like, I know you said, like, people would come and kick you out of bed, but, like, I don't know. Like, so I was on the show, The Young Rock. Maybe you've heard of it. And you know, you start like seeing like these scenes of like The Rock and his family, and then Chavo is there, and then he, you know, I'm podcasting with him, and he's telling me about how his household is one of these just like we're all barbecuing, and there's just wrestlers all over the place all the time. Is that kind of? Did you feel that, or did you feel something different? Like, or was that not necessarily the case?
Yeah, that was the case. But when it came down to it. Dad never put it on TV. Dad was never like, we're going to sit down and watch it. It was like family time.
I meant like wrestlers being over at your place.
Oh, yeah, all the time.
That's what I mean. Yeah.
Oh, my God. My Uncle Jack used to have crazy parties where like, God knows, who knows what was happening there. And then I went on Hogan's, one of his crazy parties where he rented out this huge like casino boat. And like one level was kids level, one level was family level, and the other level... I don't know. I was too young to even see what that level was all about. I don't even know if I wanted to see what that level was all about. Yeah. But, you know, it's kind of funny. I grew up always in that realm of, like, I remember Andre the Giant putting me in his hand and just lifting me up. I remember seeing The Undertaker eat 11 cheeseburgers. And I was like, I was blown away. I was like, he's going to eat 11 cheeseburgers?
As a rib or, like,
no,
he was hungry?
No, he really did.
He was hungry?
Yeah, because, like... So back in the day when they would come to Tampa,
they'd have cheeseburger eating contests.
No, I would be like a little. My dad would bring me to the show, and I would, you know, get the wrestlers whatever they wanted from catering. I would kind of be like, oh, give me Coke or whatever, and I'd go.
What?
Get them some, no, not that time. No, no, not that. Oh, Pepsi.
Thank
so,
you.
So, you know, they say, hey, like, go give me, yeah. As 11-year-old, you know, I'm slinging Coke in and out of, you know, WWE, you know. That's how I made the money. Come on now. You think I got this gold chain?
Yeah, there you go. Know?
But no, they would send me out to get, like, Pepsi, coffee, or, you know, stuff for catering, and I just would be, you know, runaround boy, and then Vince would give me, like, $50 and be like, oh, here you go. You know, so... I would just hear stuff of like, you know, oh, Taker would be like, oh, go get me 11 cheeseburgers. I'm like, whoa, dude, this guy's going to eat 11 cheeseburgers. But then, you know, he's also 6'9" or 7 foot.
So sure.
I'm sure he could eat a lot of cheeseburgers.
They fit somewhere in that body, yeah.
Yeah, for me, a little boy, I'm like, 11 cheeseburgers, man, like, that would last me a long time.
So when we first met was at in Florida Championship Wrestling under the WWE developmental system. And at that time, like, the word on you... was you were like this unbelievable wakeboarder?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I was in the X Games, and I was a professional wakeboarder for a good amount of my life. I turned pro at 17 and was able to be blessed to travel around the world. And
so tell me a little bit about the pressure or no pressure of, you know, like being the son of this, you know, unbelievable champion. And then like from an outsider's perspective, I see it like, oh, like maybe he's trying to carve his own path, but then it's like there is an in, or I don't know, you know, like, I don't, tell me what your thoughts and how it works.
To be honest with you, you hit it right on the head. I was trying to create my own path. I was trying to be Wes Briscoe. I wasn't trying to be, you know, the son of Jerry Briscoe, you know, Jack Briscoe. Like I was trying to create my own identity. And luckily I found wakeboarding and surfing, and that brought me a way to show myself and kind of create my own path. But wrestling was always in my blood, in my life. I have always loved it. It's always been a passion. But there was a one time that I was just like, I kind of have to separate myself, and I have to create my own path and my own destiny and just try things out. And of course, wrestling always brought me back, because, you know, wrestling is one of the greatest things in the world. And it was just a crazy experience, but it came in all in full circle. So
and you, where was the X Games at that you went to?
Which X Games? I've done two of them. One was in California. I don't know where the other one was. I've done so many contests and tours.
And then the decision of, like, because, I mean, I don't know if you're starting from scratch, because you, I'm sure, wrestled with your dad and your uncle, but, you know, you were like, okay, I'm going to give this a go when you were signed with the WWE. Mm-hmm. Like, tell me about that decision.
Well, before, right out of high school, I trained with Steve Kern and Eddie Graham and a couple other guys, Eddie Guerrero, too. I trained with them right out of high school. And my dad knew I wanted to create my own path. I was so much stuck in being in a shadow of my dad and my uncle that it was time that I got to kind of fill my own shoes. And, you know, and that's when I was just like, you know what? I'm going to go for it. I'm going to give it everything I got. And my dad supported me. He was like, you know what? And then I got to the point where I couldn't compete with the younger kids. I got to the point where these guys are doing triple and double flips, and I've already had two knee surgeries. So I started sitting back, and then I went and saw my Uncle Jack, and I talked to him, and he was like, boy, you should get in that ring. And I kind of went into there. And then, of course, when I went to FCW, I kind of got bullied there, too. I mean, a lot of the guys there were like, hey, you're just here because of your dad. You're not, you know what I mean? But I was there because I wanted it. I believed in it, and I love it. And that's why I'm still here today. I have not quit wrestling. I've been at every show. I give my heart out every time I step in that ring. And I'm not just here to live off my dad's name. I'm here to make my own name.
Give it up for that, for sure. And then something earlier you said was, there's always something fascinating about Puerto Rico. I mean, Brian talked about, you know, where, you know, Brody was killed. But there's so much, like, obviously, so that part of the history. But you, did you live on the island?
Yeah, right? I lived there for a year. The full year, the whole, it was crazy.
Yeah. Tell me about that, like, experience and what it was like.
Yeah, it was like right when I got released from WWE, I was like, I didn't want to give up. You know, I was like, okay, like.
Well, because in that system, sorry to cut you off, but it's just like, you might not be wrestling every day, but you're at wrestling practice. You're like, you're enthralled in that industry. And then once it gets cut off, it's like, do I go to practice tomorrow? No, I'm not welcome there anymore,
so weird, right?
It's
so the weirdest feeling.
It's very hard mentally. And I have said, and this is just a different tangent, that I think part of the release from the WWE developmental system should be like a mental health check, because, you know, like you need that.
It's so hard.
You need mental, like, everyone's going to have that bit of depression or whatever it is to kind of slide yourself out of going away from your dream job.
And not only that, it's the structure, the knowing that you got a place and knowing that you have, you know, somewhere to be, and that, you know, like, that was the hardest thing, is when that all got taken away. And of course, I was tag team champions at the time and was about to debut on Raw with Xavier Woods, and I blew my knee out. And right when I got cleared to go back, I got fired. There were so many questions of, like, what did I do wrong? You guys were just about to send me and Xavier and put us on TV and have us, like, go interrupt this pay-per-view, do this. We were on four loops. Like, it was already in the night before that we were supposed to leave for the loop, and we had to drop the title. I end up blowing my knee. Right when I came back, they were like, "Sorry,
yeah,
we ain't got nothing for you."
Wow, that's a tale as old as time.
Yeah,
I feel.
Of course.
Yeah, and it's nice that you can still, and by going to Puerto Rico, you're back at every day.
But it took a while. It took a while to get there. I had to ask my dad. I had to ask other people, and I was like, I gotta like. Because I was depressed. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know what route to go. I didn't know, you know, you're so stuck in the structure where, you know, your check comes every Tuesday. You got to be here. You got to work out. I mean, it's awesome. Like, it's the best job in the world because you get paid to do what you love. And then it gets taken away and you got to start over. And then I worked at it, and luckily Carlos gave me a chance. And then at first I was living in an apartment with one bed with three guys. Mm. It was rough. And then eventually I worked my way up where I had my own apartment. I was doing good. I had my own car. You know, like once you work your way up as a wrestler in Puerto Rico, you get more status. You get better rooms. You know,
of course, yeah.
You move up. And it was a good experience because I got to learn different styles of wrestling. And then I did Puerto Rico. Then I went to London for a while and wrestled up in Europe. And then went back to Puerto Rico. And then that's when I got signed with TNA. And then that's when the Aces and Eights and all that mm-hmm. stuff started.
A nice little transition back into the
world. Yeah, and I felt like I really needed it as a lot of wrestlers, if you grow up in the WWE system, sometimes you're kind of stuck in their ways. It's good to get out and learn different styles of wrestling and working different people. So it was kind of a blessing that I got released because I was able to work all these other countries and learn different styles of wrestling and be able to create my own style of wrestling and not be able to just be programmed as a WWE wrestler.
Yeah. Awesome. Awesome. Wes Briscoe, everybody.
Hey. Well, thanks for having me, Cole.
Thanks,
I appreciate
buddy.
It.
Hell yeah. Appreciate it. Oh. All right. I'm going to welcome my next guest to the ring, referee aficionado James Beard, everybody. Hey, man. Getting a good feel for it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You're a natural at this, man.
I mean, yeah. I like talking about wrestling.
Yeah, I think you found your spot here.
Well, hopefully.
Yeah, it's good stuff.
No one could fire me from it and make me move to Puerto Rico, so. I got that going for
That'll
me.
That'll be interesting.
First of all, I think it's nice as a referee that, well, I don't know. There's two different schools of thoughts of it. A lot of people want to say the referee should never be seen from or heard from, right?
Right.
But then it's nice also to like finally have like recognition and be known as this like Hall of Famer referee.
I've been really blessed in that, you know, and it's not really something I'd thought about when I first started doing it. I was just happy to be in the ring, you know, like a lot of guys. I was very lucky. I got to work in a pretty high-profile place in Dallas, and then I ended up in Japan and got that experience. And it's just, you know, something you don't plan. It just happens. And then after, I guess if you stay around long enough, people start recognizing
sure.
a little bit. You know, I got to do a few things other than just referee, you know, working behind the scenes and that kind of thing. And that helped. But, it's I feel really blessed that some recognition has come in the last few years,
there
especially.
Yeah. Who were some of the people that you remember used the referee the best? I don't know if you've got any examples.
You know, I was really fortunate in Dallas. A lot of them did, and of course that was a different situation in those days. It was all about work. I mean, all about creating the match as you go. And in that situation, I was...
Meaning nothing was mapped out really before.
Nothing except maybe a spot or a finish.
Yeah.
And in that situation, it really helped that I understood psychology and what they were trying to accomplish. And I could help them get to that point. And if I could do that, that was my goal, always to make the match a little bit better. And I was very involved in those situations. And just about everybody... back in those days, work matches that way. So I could say just about everybody I worked with was like that.
So nobody, when you think back,
Oh, I mean, you know, guys, the guys like, you know, like Al Perez and Johnny Mantell, Black Bart, all those guys from the Dallas area that I got to work with over and over and over again, that really understand, they can work with anybody. They get in a ring with anybody without saying a word and just have a good match. Okay. And those guys were always enjoyable to be in the ring with. And you know, Lynn Denton, the grappler, I could go on and on and on, but they're just really technically sound. And it's always fun to be in the ring with guys like that.
Would you when you look back at your career, like in your head is world class, like was that your memory of like this is when I was deep in wrestling when I was?
It was my home territory. Of course, I grew up watching the Dallas promotions from a kid. You know, I remember we lived about 90 miles from Dallas, and we were sometimes we could see the TV pretty well. It had an antenna, you know, it'd be grainy. And my folks actually took me to the sportatorium the first time when I was about 8 or 9 years old. And I saw Bull Curry and Red Bastien and Danny McShane, you know, guys that I'd seen on TV, but obviously never seen in person and bigger than life, you know. That was my home. That was my home base. Was really fortunate that later on I got to know some of those guys and got to work with some of them, like Red. Red was a dear friend, and I think the thing that really made my career is the Japanese thing. When I went over there, it changed everything for me.
If you're a full-time referee with World Class traveling the circuit?
Yeah, later on. I kind of came in there a little bit later.
Okay.
Yeah.
Like, how do you be a full-time referee, and I'm assuming not making a full-time wage as a referee?
It was tough.
Right?
It was tough. Yeah. You
hear about the wrestlers on the bottom of the card being like, I'm barely making whatever. But I imagine, are you working... Are most of those referees working within the office? Are they doing stuff?
Yeah, usually doing other things. Yeah, helping other things.
Within the actual wrestling promotion, not like another side job. Or do they do the
side job? Yeah, sometimes it is. Sometimes some guys had other jobs too.
And how do you have other jobs when doing a full-time loop?
Yeah, it's
like
tough.
Honestly.
Well, you couldn't do that and go on the loop. You have to you have to be paid. Yeah, and you just live pretty sparingly for a while, you know. And it would be rough a few times, you know.
Okay.
But I was really fortunate. You know, I got into it, and I was playing music, actually, when I got into the business. So I was kind of doing both for a while. I was kind of dabbling in this and doing this. There was a point to where it just got to a point to where you got to make a decision, do one or the other, and I was fortunate that I guess they liked me well enough to at least make me enough to make I could live on it for a while,
right.
And then I got the deal in Japan, and that changed everything.
Okay, yeah. And now when you talk about the deal in Japan, you were part of the SWS Super Show, is that correct?
Yeah.
What does that move on to?
They had a lot of politics involved in this, but SWS ended up splitting because of some infighting with the upper end, and I ended up going with NOW, which was Kendo Nagasaki Sakurada. I'm sure you probably knew him. He was a good friend. He's the guy that took me over there the first time, and when they split, he asked me to go with him, and when he did that, he kind of put me in charge of booking guys and booking a lot of the booking in the matches and that kind of thing. So it was a good situation for me.
So, I mean, you know, logistically, I'm always thinking like it'd be hard to bring over a referee to Japan full time.
Yeah.
Or on a full time touring schedule or whatever.
Yeah. The first time I went over, they were having their grand opening, SWS was. And I thought, you know, Sakurada asked me to go and I thought it was just a one-shot deal. Yeah. They had two shots in Yokohama, and about 17,000 people both nights. It was pretty cool, and had their big grand opening, and it was a real big production and everything, and things went really well. And I went to get my payoff that night, and Kabuki, who was one of the bookers, handed me my money, and he said, "You come back next month," and. I came back the next month. The first half of the tour was just Japanese guys and myself. And I stayed and worked in the training center. Which that was another thing. That's the first time I really started working with training guys.
Yeah.
And then I stayed over for the next tour. And that's how it worked. I'd go and do a tour, work in the training center, and then do another touring and come home, then go back and do that again.
And you were part of that WWF versus SWF like big show.
Yeah.
Can you take us through some memories of that? Was that like Chomp? No.
It was at the Tokyo Dome.
At the Tokyo Dome. Yeah. I'm trying to think of the matches. I don't.
It was crazy. Yeah, Hogan and I get them mixed up now. Hogan and Tenyu, and they ended up, I think, on the winner had a return or something. They may have even tagged together. I don't remember, but the thing I remember about it is. Earthquake and they had a guy.
Oh, the shoot fight.
Yes.
Holy shit. So yes. For those who don't know, I can't think of his name. I don't know if you know.
What was it? He was a sumo champion.
Yeah. No, it wasn't Granite. It was a Japanese brother. It was John Tenta. Koji Kato, why not ask the room of wrestling fans?
Yeah, why not? Yeah, they remember things we don't remember. Yeah.
And they both are. I don't know the exact heat, but they both are like sumo wrestlers, and they both don't want to sell for each other. And there's like 40,000 people, and they don't they do 8 minutes of like, well, if I go for the shoot, I might lose, so I don't want to I want to shoot on this guy, but I don't want to lose in front of him. And it's one of the most interesting. It's very much like Great Antonio and Antonio Inoki, where it's just this wild thing that happened. And you were there for that.
Yeah, the heat was in the office. It was with what's his name?
Koji Kata.
Yeah. He had been brought in, you know, after he was a sumo champion, and they were trying. I think he'd worked some in maybe Bob's promotion or somewhere before, trained a little. And Tenyu had brought him in. He wanted to make a big deal out of him. And kind of the drift I got while I was there is he wouldn't show up at the training center. And wasn't training the way they wanted him to.
And you're hearing all of this firsthand from Earthquake, too? Is he like...
No, not from Earthquake. This is coming from the Japanese guys.
Okay, yeah, but you're not like... Yeah, I mean, as an American, being able to speak English with Earthquake,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, because I'm in the training center every day, so I didn't even see the guy. He may be coming there once or twice, you know, and I could hear all the rumbling and everything. And, of course, I knew Tenyu and Kabuki and those guys, and they were the upper echelon of the company, and Sakurada, too. Mm-hmm. And they weren't happy with him. And the drift I got was that the thing with Earthquake is he was kind of told to make it rough on him.
Okay.
And that's how that started.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then what was the aftermath? Like, were you in the locker room for this stuff?
He got mad and he jumped out of the ring and took off and just left.
Just left.
Yeah.
Okay. And then what did Earthquake vent to you afterwards or anything?
Not to me, okay. But there was a little excitement in the dressing room for a while.
Yeah, I'd imagine one of the most interesting things. This is all I always find interesting. Like when do you realize I can't, the refereeing and all this stuff has to kind of slow down for me and I might have to hit into real life.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I'm kind of at this stage now. I feel like, you know, that old saying that I'm still as good as I once I ever was, but maybe once, that's it, you know, that kind of deal. You get to that point, you know. And I was always interested in the creative side of things and booking and helping and training and that kind of thing. So that's something that's kind of carried me this far. You know, cool. I continue to be involved in that, and it's satisfying for me.
And then tell me your favorite Von Erich memory.
Oh, my gosh. You know, it's kind of weird. There's so many of them because I knew Kerry was a good friend, a really dear friend. I don't know if this would be a favorite memory or not, but it's one that stands out for me. And it was in Japan, too. He was working with WWF at the time. And they were on a tour over there because we were working with them. They would come over and we'd do tours with them. And we went out one night, myself with Kerry and Rick Martel, Shawn Michaels, may have been somebody else, I don't remember. But anyway, we'd gone out and had a pretty big time. And we came back to the hotel and Kerry said, let's go downstairs and I want something to eat. You know, it was late and they were about to close and all they had was pie. So we ordered a whole pie, a big something. And I said, Kerry, I don't, you know. So I sat there with him for a while and I said, I got to go to bed, man. He said, I said, you know. Finally, I got up and left. And the next morning, John calls me and he says, have you seen Kerry? I'm going man, I saw him last night. He went to bed, I guess. We got to looking for him. He was out in the hall, leaning up against the door, asleep. It didn't get into his room. He was laying there like this. you know. Yeah. And he was just, you know, he said, oh, I couldn't find my key, so I just went to sleep. And then later on, he told me, he said, yeah, I had my key, but I got to thinking about David in his room when he died, and I couldn't go in there, you know. I mean, that kind of a morbid memory, but that's
deep. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's
wild. Yeah.
And it sticks with you.
Yeah.
That's definitely something that would stick
absolutely,
with me.
Absolutely,
yeah. Very interesting. All right. James Beard, everybody.
Thank you, guys.
Last but not least, I'm excited to bring in the main event of the show. Dressed to the Nines, please give it up for Hollywood Rock Riddle. Uh-oh. He's breaking format.
Breaking format. I notice, and I will tell you this, sir.
For those of you at home, Rock Riddle is now in the crowd. He refuses to come sit next to me. Go on.
Well, it's a traumatic thing if I come sit next to you as the, and I just did a count, as the 517 people who are in the audience. And those are 517 who stayed in the audience.
Yes.
No one walked out. The reason they didn't, because they saw that Rock Riddle was still here and there was still a chance for them to be able to experience this amazing man in person.
How could these 517 people see all the way through that door to the luxurious green room where I have caviar and sushi waiting for you? I mean, I guess maybe they heard you bragging about all the wonderful, luxurious items that are back there.
I don't brag about anything. And the reason that I hesitated to come out here and sit back down next to you was because this is something that has never been done before.
A podcast?
No. Actually, I think those have been done before.
You putting yourself over?
Yes, I have never put myself over before. Sitting down next to you for the first time publicly, I think everyone should, oh my gosh, the people who are listening, they're missing out, but everyone here in person, the 517 people, look at this. Two of the handsomest, most talented people on the planet together in the same spot.
I don't even know if these people can handle this.
They all live vicariously through people like you and I.
That's true. Now, Rock, the original Rock.
And the original, see, we can say this since Brian is out of the room.
Go on.
It was his very good friend, so the original Mr. Wonderful on professional wrestling.
That's right.
So here he is, direct from his palatial estate, high in the hills of Hollywood, California. The first, the only, the original Mr. Wonderful of professional wrestling, the Diamond Ring and Lamborghini Man, the man who possesses the body that men fear and women love, the intercontinental lover, the Rolls Royce of wrestling, Rock Riddle!
Wow. Justin Roberts flashbacks I was having right there.
You did a great job of introducing me, but I thought I could do an even better job. Because as much as you love and admire me, love in a masculine way, of course.
No, not sexually also.
Oh, you... You are the first man in my life who ever found me attractive.
Nope.
No gay guys ever found me attractive. I missed out. And now you find me attractive. I want to see if we can end this podcast right now. Come back to my suite. I've got like half of a room on the 8th floor. Mm-hmm. They gave me this. It's amazing. And you and I can sit down and talk about that.
Yeah, I'd hit it for sure.
Yeah.
For sure. Unbelievable. Rock, let's talk a little bit about professional wrestling. First of all, were you a little upset? Well, tell me about, like, honestly, I know you're a gimmick, but were you upset, A, when Mr. Wonderful Paul Orndorff made it on television with Mr. Wonderful, and B, when The Rock pronounced himself as The Rock?
Okay. First of all, my understanding is that Paul Orndorff was a very nice person. The wrestler, instead of showing you a lot of the person here, who has that character, if you will, so close to the skin and it wants to come out, and I can just feel it and say, and we can start talking about how ugly the fans are and all the story. Wait, I have to be me. Okay, so the reality is, I wish he had come to me and said, Rock, you're not real active in the business at that particular point. I'd like to sort of use that gimmick. What do you think? Most likely, I would have said, yeah, go ahead.
Is this The Rock or Paul Orndorff?
Paul Orndorff. Okay. But he never did that. I don't know. It may have been my very good, dearly departed friend, Mr. Roddy Piper. It may have been Roddy Piper who suggested it to him. I never asked Roddy, but Roddy may have said, hey, look, Rock is sort of going into semi-retirement a little bit. And little did he know I would make such an amazing comeback. He was using this gimmick. He has this great gimmick, this Mr. Wonderful gimmick. Why don't we use that?
And what about
I don't know what I can say,
Rock?
But okay.
What about Rock?
I was at an event in Las Vegas. Atta Johnson, who is The Rock's mom, she had just finished an interview with someone amazing, not on your level of amazement,
obviously,
but someone amazing in some, I think it was a national television interview. But she had just finished up. Yeah, you're international. This was only national.
I'm internet-ational.
Oh, that too. Well. So Atta was in. My friend Atta had just finished this national, not international.
Great edit point, by the way. Go on.
Had just finished this interview. When I walked in, I heard the last thing she was saying about her son. And I said, you know, I was The Rock before The Rock was The Rock. I was Rock before Rocky was Rocky. And of course, I was the... And she said, stop. She looked at the cinematographer, the videographer. She said, roll your cameras. She says, we need this on video. We need to record this. I want to record this and send a copy to my son. So I started the whole thing even going further in there, talking about sort of putting down her son a bit and how he's attempting to copy me. The real original Rock, the original Mr. Wonderful. Look at the imposters out there, those who attempt to be me, and they never will be. Anyway, we did a little bit like that, and she said, Rock Riddle, you are atrocious. My son Rock is the only real true Rock. And I said, come over and stand next to me when you say that. And he said, look over here, cheat the camera, as they say. Put your arm around me. Okay, zoom in on this face. Dwayne, your mom and I are running away together.
Did you ever work with Rocky Johnson?
I did not.
Okay.
I worked with his father. And when I was very, very young, when I was brand new, and of course I started as a teenager in professional wrestling, as did you. Right?
Yeah.
You were, what, 17?
18.
You waited until you were 18. Yeah. Yeah, that's okay. You've done well.
I got 516 people to come watch a podcast.
When I was in my early, early professional days, I was working for Roy Scheider and in San Francisco, obviously. Great guy. Roy would fly me in and out. He liked me. And he said, come on up. I want you to be under a mask, under a hood, as is the inside terminology in this business. So that's why I'm not going to share that information with any of you fans. But if there are actual real wrestlers out there. So I'm in the dressing room with Peter Maivia, who is Dwayne's grandfather. He was past time to retire, but he was close to actual retirement from the professional wrestling business. So when he came into the dressing room, I had the mask on. And I said, hey, you, yeah, you, old time guy. I beat your butt in Moxie Cali. I would go out here and beat you up again.
And you were 17?
Because you're old and you passed. I was probably 18.
Wow. Okay, go on.
I'm going to take you out there and beat you from corner to corner, and you're gonna like it because you're in there with someone who's much better than you, just like in Mexicali when I beat you. I continued doing this. He continues getting really angry. He's to the point that he's standing up, moving in my direction, And I ended it by saying, "You don't have no idea with whom you're dealing. Watch this." I took the mask off, and then he saw it was me, so it was okay.
You had a relationship with him beforehand, though.
Yes, he knew who I was.
Okay, okay.
But he did not recognize me under the mask.
Okay, that's good.
Yes.
Track Riddle, everybody. Thank you, my friend. Appreciate you. Thanks, sir. Okay? It was a lot of fun. Ladies and gentlemen, this has been The Art of Wrestling. Thank you so much for being here. We are in front of a live studio audience here in Waterloo, Iowa. Hey, before we get out of here, I am going to go back to my studio apartment right now so I can do some plugs and...
upcoming events!
All right, welcome back to the studio apartment. My Patreon, patreon.com/ColtCabana, where you can listen to ad-free archives of almost all 500 episodes of The Art of Wrestling, ad-free archives of Wrestling Anonymous, and new bonus Wrestling Anonymous episodes just for the Patreon twice a month, plus Rock Riddle and Brian Blair going off on some stories. I do have different tiers. I can also send you a vinyl sticker every month, and I can also handwrite you an envelope and give you a little fun nickname. You can check out older episodes of Wrestling Anonymous and Pro Wrestling Fringe up for free wherever you get podcasts. Grab some merch at coltmerch.com. Brand new Upper Deck signed cards. A brand new comic signed by me and Daniel Warren Johnson. I got new autographed pictures, stickers, micro brawlers, the usual stuff. Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, and YouTube are all at Colt Cabana. I'm on Twitch playing games all the time. Twitch.tv/ColtCabana. That's free to watch if you just want to hang out. ColtWrestling@gmail.com is my very public email. That's where you can hit me up for shows, conventions, any business or non-business stuff. Or send me something fun to my P.O. box, which can be found on my website, ColtCabana.com. Upcoming events, August 9th through the 21st at the Monkey Barrel in Edinburgh, Scotland. Come see me and John Hastings at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. Saturday, September 3rd, I'm going to be in Mesa, Arizona for Party Hard Wrestling's final show. September 10th, I'll be at the Mall of America for First Wrestling Saturday Nitro. October 1st, 1PW in Doncaster, England at the Doncaster Dome. Team Shag is making a comeback. Also, I got shows coming up in New York, Chicago, Baltimore, and more. Stay updated on the socials and my website. Podcast cover art and design is by Jimmy Lee and photo by James Musselwhite. Thank you to my forever sponsor, OneHourTees.com. They help run ProWrestlingTees.com. That's where you can buy all of my shirts and cameo-style video messages called shoots right over at ProWrestlingTees.com/ColtCabana. That's it for the plugs and the upcoming events. I'm going to send you back to the live show, and then we'll finish this thing off. Feel free to skip the ads at the end.
And we're back. Hello. Everyone really enjoyed those plugs and upcoming events. Thanks, everybody, for supporting me. We appreciate it. But I do want to thank the National Wrestling Hall of Fame, which happens every single year, usually the end of July here in Waterloo, Iowa. It's always a great crowd. There's great legends that come here. I think it's like an unsung hero of the professional wrestling world, maybe because it's Midwest, and Midwest just doesn't get the love that we deserve. But it is a great thing that happens. And also, the National Wrestling Hall of Fame is open 24/7, I believe. If anyone ever wants to go there, they'll make sure it's open. You can see the museum. If you ever go through Waterloo, Iowa, please come and visit, but definitely make a weekend of it next year. I do want to thank the National Wrestling Hall of Fame and IPW and Troy and everybody for setting this up. I do want to thank my guests. Please give a round of applause for B. Brian Blair, Wes Briscoe, James Beard, and Rock Riddle. There he is. Thanks, everybody. This has been The Art of Wrestling. For Colt Cabana, I'm Colt Cabana. Thanks. All right. Thank you so much for coming. We're going to do a fun little podcast here. This is being recorded. It's being put on the internet, so don't say anything stupid, Rock.
Enter other things also. Ooh, look at the minds of these people out here. They're laughing at things there where they should not be laughing. They're giving away their secrets, just like you gave away yours. But thank you for finding me attractive.
You got it.
You're not bad looking, I guess, for a guy. I mean, you're not my type because you're not female, but I don't know. You know all women are trouble, right?
I won't co-sign off of that, but you're welcome to say it.
Well, wait a minute. There's no place for females
what
in professional wrestling.
Right,
isn't that what you said?
What are you trying to do to me? The Rock trying to get me canceled on my own show.